Okay, I'm not going to say much more except to say it's good.
Yeah, you're going to get a very one-sided account here. I actually planned this as a sort of a combative account. I thought, you know, well, we are lecturing to a bunch of painites about pain. And my job is to sort of come in and say, no, I'll give a duff toss about pain in the 18th century. Yes, it's not. So you're going to get that side. You're going to go, well, where's pain coming to this? You know, you're telling me anything about pain, then you're telling me that people didn't like him much. But that's really what we're going to get. But we'll develop it in questions, I expect, and get a bit more. So let's start here. Let's start here, Copenhagen Fields, Copenhagen House, London, 1795, October 1795, the London Corresponding Society, meeting en masse in public, petitioning and remonstrating and addressing their monarch. And thousands of them, huge, huge meeting. 1795, 3 years after the London Corresponding Society had first come into being in order to try to achieve universal landed suffrage. 3 years down the line, with failed petitions, failed addresses to the throne, failed remonstrances to the king. And what are they doing in 1795? They're doing it all again. And this is our question, isn't it? Why is it, despite everything they've been advised, by Paine in particular, by Tom Paine, did English radicals looking for universal suffrage persist in laying petitions, addresses, and remonstrances before the throne? Tom Paine was really clear about petitioning. He said, petitioning is the right of slaves to complain. And he's always right about these things, you know, but it doesn't stop people behaving in a silly way. And it's, of course, it's true. But it's a sort of it's a rational view. It's an enlightened view. Of course it is. It's straightforward. You could follow Tom Paine if you wanted to in the 18th century. It was a perfectly viable, radical option. It went more or less like this. We don't have a producible, material constitution. There's no point pretending that we do, but we should have. And until we do, we are not properly governed. All this means, Paine says, that you can't talk about restoring or reforming the constitution, because we haven't got one. It's as simple as that. You cannot restore, you cannot recover. So as James Epstein, the historian, says, for disciples of Tom Paine, this is a quote from Epstein, history and custom were polluting agents, enemies of reason and philosophy. But the thing is, we can't just pretend that Paineite republicanism had some sort of massive influence in 18th century England. We can't just pretend that everyone listened to that and said, oh, well, it's quite right. Of course. And the question is, why not? Why didn't it have the purchase that rational, enlightened people would think that it should? Well, some historians will probably stand in front of you and tell you that it's because Britons loved their constitution, like they believed they had one, and they loved it so much it made them God-fearing and loyal, and they just wanted everyone to stay at home and look after themselves and everything would be all right. We were staunchly loyal, and so of course we loved our king. There are endless numbers of historians who will argue that this is why we didn't have a revolution in the 1790s. They were therefore loath to rebel about anything. That, in my view, would be incredibly simplistic. For a start, I will argue, that it's perfectly possible to be constitutionally attached, to have a belief in the constitution, and be rebellious at one and the same time. And in fact, for many 18th century radicals, the two went together very neatly. One could be rebellious with some prospects of success because one was a constitutionalist. Right? And that's the sort of stuff we're going to have to unwrap in the course of the next hour or so. The non-republican, non-Paineite radical option was, surprisingly, flexible, discursive, constructive. It involved a belief in an ancient constitution. It's often called, they talked about the ancient constitution, or they talked about the Anglo-Saxon constitution when they were really tied down and trying to be specific. But they didn't try to be specific too often. It was an ancient constitution that owed about as much to custom as it did to law, which is one reason why we couldn't see it written down anywhere. But it was understood that this ancient customary constitution had been fortified by law through the ages. So you could trace the way in which this customary constitution, which no one could produce and everyone thought to be there, was the constitution of the mind, had nevertheless been underwritten and fortified by law, a bit like moral economy, actually. And usually after a struggle as well. And the signposts were things like Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights in 1689, habeas corpus, the right to trial by jury, these little sort of signposts that an egalitarian constitution of ancient vintage was being slowly underpinned by acts of law. And this constitution, the belief in it, was bolstered by belief in another powerful myth, the idea of ancient common law, as opposed to statute law. The idea of common law itself derived from a belief in an Anglo-Saxon practice. It was understood that common law was based upon the civil and political liberties of the freeborn Englishman, who was freeborn in Anglo-Saxon England. Thomas Wooler, editor of the Black Dwarf, put it this way in 1817. The common law is the ancient common law, which, in its mild and just provisions, equally protected the peasant in his cottage and the king upon his throne. The Black Dwarf, if you've never read it, have you read it? It's tremendous. But it's often characterised as a sort of a rigid, ultra-radical, republican journal, magazine of the sort of ultra-radical republican movements, you know. But you look through it carefully and it's full of these constitutionalist gestures. Radicals and Whigs, between them, have certain things in common when they're looking back, using history to justify a position. But the radicals tended to part company from the Whigs in seeing 1688, the Glorious Revolution, Magna Carta and so on, not so much as proof of a modern constitution, but as attempts to recover something much older from it. So we'll talk about that in a bit, but there's a difference about how we see. They both agree 1688 and Magna Carta are something important. You know, this question of what they're important for, what do they actually demonstrate? And these radicals, as I say, like to look back to an Anglo-Saxon golden age, whenever they can. It's what Edward Thompson would have called one of the peculiarities of the English. This is not a tradition you can trace in many other European states. The French, for example, needed to have a revolution in 1789 without any recourse to an ancient mythical, Anglo-Saxon, would it? A sort of ancient medieval constitution or some golden age of constitutional splendour that they were restoring. They weren't restoring at all. They didn't think they were restoring. They had no myths like that to adhere to. They needed to create a revolution out of abstract principles of republican virtue. That's why it occurred pretty much in the way that it did. And the constitutional experiments between 1789 and 1792, as you know, were a complete utter bloody disaster, because the king didn't understand them and wouldn't play ball. it is a peculiarity of the English, I think, and again, a good example of why we need to study these things discreetly in particular countries. You know, it's different wherever you are. They're different from country to country. They're never the same. In practice, I think it's true to say that most English radicals, certainly of the 1790s, completely fudged the question of whether history, on the one hand, precedent, the past, or abstract reason and philosophy, were the best justifications for constitutional change. They kind of fudge it. They don't like to argue it's one or the other. They just kind of mix them together in a sort of terribly woolly soup. You know what it must be like. Now, this is not to say that they didn't. Well, perhaps I don't know whether they acknowledge it or not. There are problems for them. There are problems in the sense that there are severe limitations placed upon any radical movement that bases its entire understanding of what's possible on what has apparently been possible in the past. You cannot invent out of thin air things which didn't previously exist. So, for example, it doesn't offer a great deal of hope for feminism, because however they sort of re-scripted Anglo-Saxon England, they never managed to make it a matriarchy. They certainly never managed to make it a place where women could vote. So it doesn't sort of offer a constitutional solution to feminist problems. People like Richard Carlyle and Robert Owen were much better at dragging radicalism, male radicalism, towards feminist issues, but of course they were not constitutionalists at all, not a bit. The other thing it doesn't provide any kind of solution for is the problem of inequalities in property, and particularly those related to land. The economic power of the elite in most radical discourse remains completely unchallenged. It's not the issue. The issue is about who can vote. Citizenship is based upon accountability rather than on inequality of property. And in fact, in the English tradition, individual liberty, the liberties of the individual, were completely bound up with the historical claims to the rights of individual property. You know, the one is supposedly sort of guaranteed the other. You needed Thomas Spence and his land plan to come in as a sort of an alternative current in the 1790s to provide a solution for the land problem. But I don't know, do you know about Thomas Spence? It's a slight digression, this, but Thomas Spence is the road not taken. All the radical English tradition heads off towards the ballot box as its sort of place of destination. If we can get political power, folks, we can remake the world. What we want is a vote. If we've got a vote, we've got political power, and it's all right. Spence always said that was rubbish. Spence said, you give someone political power, that's all right, but if they haven't got property, they're at the mercy of the landlords, constantly. Their votes are not worth the paper they're written on, because they will be manipulated. So we've got to sort out social and economic inequalities before we can sort out political inequalities. That was Spence's view. And he had this fantastic thing called his land plan. Well, everyone else was trying to get the vote and demanding universal suffrage. Spence is going, right, what we do is this. We seize the land, all the land in the country, and it will be administered by the people for the people. It will be run by parish councils. Every parish will administer its own land, and everyone in the parish will vote every time a decision needs to be made about what will be done with the land. So if a bloke in one parish says, I think I'd like to open a biscuit factory, that's at a parish meeting. They say, you want to open a biscuit factory? Where are you going to put that? Well, in the field at the back of my house. Well, all those in favour of a biscuit factory in the field at the back of his house. Well, you say aye. All right then, so we're going to have biscuits. That's good. We could trade our biscuits with the next door parish because they've got a butter factory. This is the way exchange would be simple, but every decision would be made from the lowest possible point. So it was totally devolved democracy, parish-based. No one ever owned any land except the people of the parish, and they only kind of administered it. Land ownership didn't really enter into Spence's vocabulary. He's a really, really interesting bloke. Not only did men vote in the parishes, but women, and he even proposed that children, I think at the age of 5 or 6 or something, should probably be allowed to vote as well. Everyone should have a say. It's a fantastic thing, but it is the path not taken in English radical politics, very much the path not taken. That was a bit of a dive. Where were we? That's right, yes. So this is the thing about Spence. He has no constitutional legacy of common land ownership to fall back upon. He has to invent his land plan out of thin air, really, and with a handful of allusions to the diggers, I think, here and there in his writing. But, of course, that gets him talking about the commons and common land. But Spence is going way beyond this. So you can have commons alongside private land, but that's not contestable. For Spence, it's never mind the private land and the commons. It's all the commons, all of it. Every blade of grass belongs to the people. And so he hasn't got a historical basis to fall back upon. And when he does try to use history, it's very loose and fluid. He says, landed property always was originally acquired either by conquest or by encroachment on the common property of mankind. That's a historical remark, isn't it? It always was, that's a fact. And it's okay, therefore, to seize the land back now from modern landowners because, quote, those modern purchasers are not ignorant of the manner in which landed property was originally obtained. So they're guilty by association. They shouldn't have taken it. They shouldn't have bought it in the first place. They knew it had been robbed from the people. Because Spence's big problem, of course, was ultimately that since he knew that social and economic redistribution of the land was the most important thing to do, and he'd already decided that if you just kind of took a vote, you got a vote in Parliament, that wouldn't really help because the landlords obviously wouldn't allow it. How do you actually get the land back? It would have to be through violent insurrection. And that's never been a terribly popular option amongst most English people, We even laugh about it here, cops, right? Well, I get it. We're not French. hurrah! So Spencianism represents a road not taken, and its lack of cultural purchase, historical purchase perhaps, is linked to a paucity of any precedents for anything you might actually wanted to do. Some radicals were never really entirely sure where they stood on these sort of issues, but they find Tom Paine intellectually appealing, and he is intellectually appealing, but then they're going to go, but we quite like the king. So John Thelwall, who we see here shaking his fist under an umbrella, Copenhagen Fields, leading orator for the London Corresponding Society, he would agree with Paine on a number of counts. He would certainly agree with Paine, and he did, but the trouble with using history and precedent to underpin what you did was that there were simply far too many conflicting precedents to choose from. If you've got a sort of wealth of historical precedents to choose from, it's pretty obvious we can all play the game of choosing the right ones and go, there you go, see, that's it, that's the way it goes. No, because over here it works slightly different. You know, precedents are loose, fluid, difficult, slippery things. So he realised it was a game anybody could play, and he wasn't too keen on playing it. And he also acknowledged that in the end, if that's the way you're going to play things, the people who will decide which are the right precedents and which are the wrong precedents are the people in power. It is going to be the rich and the powerful, and they won't make the decisions that are in the interests of the people. A good example, actually, of how radicals could get themselves into trouble by quoting these kind of abstract, well not abstract, but apparently real, historical Anglo-Saxon consciences about the old constitution, is that Maurice Margrove is a member of the London Corresponding Society, put on trial for sedition and treason in 1793 in Scotland for trying to hold a convention, being a delegate to the Scottish Convention of that year. And at his trial, he tried to argue in front of the entire Scottish court, that he had a right to do what he was doing because he was just invoking Anglo-Saxon precedent, and it was perfectly valid, and so on. It was history, and he shouldn't complain about it. The Lord Advocate just sort of cut him off and made very short work of exposing what turned out to be Marlborough's rather deficient historical knowledge of both Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights. The trouble was, in a courtroom, usually, well-trained barristers knew a damn lot about the Bill of Rights and constitutional framework law. You know, it was kind of difficult for a radical to argue their way in that sort of enchanted castle. So as the Lord Advocate said, I've got his quote here, right then, he says, let them all go back to the history of England. Let them go back to the deepest antiquity. It never did exist. Those people of whom Mr. Marlborough seems to be the ghostly father had never heard of the Bill of Rights, nor the claim of rights, and they knew not what rights they had lost. And he lost, basically. Using these historical precedents, in other words, was quite difficult. John Thelwall, much more canny character, he was much more sophisticated in his treatment of precedent, and he dealt with it very thoroughly in a publication in 1796 called The Rights of Nature, which is an absolutely fantastic piece, I think, The Rights of Nature. It's certainly his best piece of theoretical writing. And in it, he contested Edmund Burke, who wrote the Reflections on the Revolution in France and is usually presented in schoolboy history books as the arch-enemy of Tom Paine. The two of them kind of battle it out across the channel. Thelwall contested Edmund Burke over the place of history and precedent in rational argument. And the thing was, in Burke's Reflections, in the Reflections on the Revolution in France in 1790, Burke had advocated a constitution for England. Well, he advocated, he sort of defended the existence of a constitution in England based on precedent from Magna Carta as a sort of an inheritance. It starts with Magna Carta and we built it up from there. He denied any attempts to underpin it with natural rights. There were no natural rights. Natural rights don't exist for Burke. They're kind of ethereal, ephemeral nonsenses. They don't happen. They're not. You can't base a constitution on natural rights, he says. And there's no natural rights underpinning the gains that we've picked up from Magna Carta and slowly accumulated over a period of years since then. Burke locates the basis for our constitution in a sort of slowly evolving, he calls it Germanic or Gothic customary. But he just means a sort of a customary culture relating back to the Gothic period. In other words, it's something produced by historical processes. Thelwall said that was utter crap. He says, historical processes cannot precede civil society. You can't have a historical process which begins before people do, because history is the history of people. It hasn't no other meaning. So historical processes must therefore have philosophical and abstract origins. They must have. A customary, as Burke likes to call it, can only have arisen by three possible routes: by chance, by usurpation, or by right. Thelwall says, right, well, look, since both chance and usurpation fall rather well outside the Enlightenment moral compass, they're not really sort of, they're not a good basis for founding a constitution and feeling patriotic pride, are they? Is it just happened by chance, right? We're just lucky, or it happened by usurpation, well, we can't obviously defend that. So that can't be that, so therefore it must have its origins in right, he says. And in that case, it's the origins of that right which need investigation, not just the origins by which the constitution was built upon that right. We've got to get down to what he calls original principles. You know, we've got to get down to first principles in order to understand what's going on. In terms of usefulness, Thelwall says, it's far more important to discover what the objects of association ought to be than to be informed what they actually have been. We can't use history to discover first principles because they precede it. That's the top quote there. He goes on, history, obscure with respect to the early transactions of particular states, is of necessity silent as to the beginnings of constituted society. In other words, history cannot uncover the origins of rights. It's not something that history can do. It might legitimately be used to trace the origins of phenomena that have arisen from civil society. So you might use history to trace the origins of property, for example, the development of theories of property. You might use it to trace events like Magna Carta and the progress of the Bill of Rights and so on, these kind of things. The progress of society itself can be traced through history, but never its origins. And Thelwall's really clear about this. He says that Burke makes the mistake of thinking that it can be. Thelwall says, history is to be consulted not for precedents that must be followed, but by examples that should be weighed, not for dogmas to restrain, but for circumstances to illustrate our speculations, and as far as they extend, for landmarks to direct our course. So Thelwall is clear about the status of the ancient constitution. It is older, and therefore more pertinent, than anything that arose from it later. That's why it's important. It's older and more pertinent, obviously, than the Norman invasion. It's older and more pertinent than Magna Carta. But it's not an end in itself. Rather, it's an effect of a social compact taking place in a state of nature. He says the Anglo-Saxon world is a world in it's a sort of an Arcadia to Thelwall. It is a state of nature in which everything else, in which people build civil society for the first time. And because they're in a state of nature and the rights of nature therefore pertain, the first civil society that grows out of it is a good one. It's an exemplary one. This that made it important and showed exactly how the rights of nature, that is, first principles, were adapted by the first civil societies. And quite unlike Paine, John Thelwall remained obsessed by these Anglo-Saxon origins of civil society throughout his life. So in many ways, Thelwall is regarded as the greatest exponent of Paineism. I mean, he is the great orator of the London Corresponding Society, the man who communicates the ideas of Tom Paine and Rights of Man to a wider audience. But he's so unlike Paine in this kind of nagging thing about the Anglo-Saxons. He's got an English peculiarity about him that he cannot quite let go of. Most sort of moderately reform-minded Whigs had sort of Burkish views about historical precedents. Of course they did, because they provided justifications for the Glorious Revolution, to which all Whigs owed their political strength in the 1790s, because the Glorious Revolution had limited the power of the crown and so on. So you get these sort of, can't see that very well, can you? So not very good. But it's sort of, there's a classic kind of Whig deification of 1688, the Glorious Revolution, with all the sort of heroes, these kind of propertied sort of Whig grandees at the top, all identified with numbers over their heads. this great old thing about how wonderful the Glorious Revolution has been, all the things the Bill of Rights has given us. It's a real foundation document, the Bill of Rights 1689 for the Whigs, a real foundation document. Many of them never want to go back further than it. You know, 1688 is really the benchmark. They don't want to talk very much about Magna Carta. 1688 is where law begins, as far as they're concerned, in the modern world. And as certainly well understood, the law, the English law, the law of the law courts, the law of Parliament, defined allegiance to the Constitution purely in terms of the Constitution of 1688, of the Glorious Revolution. And, you know, Thelwall is wise enough to know that that matters. Radicals, on the other hand, obviously had to dig further back than 1688, quite obviously, because 1688, whatever it had done, it might have limited the power of the Crown a little, but it had not conferred universal suffrage, and since that was what they were after, and that's what, of course, they had to be after, then obviously it wasn't a perfect act. What's more, 1688 hadn't been strong enough to prevent infringements on the liberties it apparently conferred in later years. There have been all kinds of things gone wrong since. Thelwall only had to, the London Correspondence Society only had to point at the ways in which their own activities were being curtailed by the state, contrary to all the laws of free expression and assembly that 1688 was supposed to have secured. So obviously it was faulty, it didn't have mechanisms to prevent abuses from occurring. And the other thing they would say, of course, is that if 1688, if the great glorious revolution of 1688, the turfing out of a monarch and the bringing in of another, at gunpoint, you know, if that was actually legitimate in 1688, as of course all the Whigs and everybody else argued that it was, then Britons must surely have had a right before it, and regardless of law, to challenge existing constitutions. Whatever the law said in 1687, you know, Britons obviously had a right, didn't they, to ignore the law and overthrow the existing constitution and establish a better one. And if that was the case then, the same right must pertain now and at all times. And so we have just as much right now to overthrow a constitution and bring in another. Therefore, 1688 could not possibly have been the be-all and end-all, you know, the sort of stop, the final act. And you know, radicals are full of beautiful illustrations. Is it some from the 1770s? You sometimes get these illustrations of the constitution. The constitution imagined as a structure, a pyramidal structure of kind of three mutually supporting beams, one representing the commons, one the crown, and one the lords. They're all the same size, oddly. And they all support one another, because they're forces that support one another. And so you get these sort of loyal things that show, this is how strong, see how strong we are, we all lean against one another, and we get this great kind of A-framed sort of tent thing we can shelter under. And in things like this, they're just sort of emphasising the whole thing is rotten. The wood is rotten, it's crumbling, it's all falling down. And the structs are made of the right things. Look, Magna Carta written up one on the left-hand side, election on the bottom there. But it's all rotten, it's all falling down. Something needs to be done. And it's often felt that the king had played a fairly significant part in the falling down process, in the allowing it to rot. So in this one, which is from 1784, what we see here is Prime Minister Pitt here, carefully kicking down one of the pillars that holds up the constitution where Britannia sits. She's about to go toppling there. She's clutching to her bosom the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights and the habeas corpus, all these important things. Poor old Charles James Fox is trying to hold on to her hand, but it's not going to work because Pitt is determined to kick that Commons of England away. Whilst the king here is sort of, he's got some kind of rope, he's pulling on what appears to be a tuba. I'm sure that must be a reference I haven't quite understood. But he's pulling on a throne, isn't it? And yanking her down. And so the king and Pitt together are conspiring to destroy the constitution, conspiring to destroy liberty, because Britannia represents liberty, the liberties of all of us. And he's holding out this picture here of you can't really see it very well, it's a picture of a king with a proper spiky crown thing on, and it says Sweden on it. Sweden, not Sweden. And the king is meant to look at that and go, oh yes, right, because they just had a kind of coup in Sweden and developed a much stronger monarchy. That's a good idea, thank you very much, Prime Minister, I'll take that on board. So there's a lot of cynicism about what's happening to the constitution, and of course to the king's role in it. But what we want to do now, I think, is get to grips a little with this Anglo-Saxon constitution, because we don't know what it's supposed to represent yet, do we? In the 1770s, its greatest advocate is a man called Obadiah Holm. We come here to talk about Tom Paine, you've heard of him, but I'm going to tell you about Obadiah Holm. I don't know very much about him, actually. He wrote this, an historical essay on the English Constitution. This is an essay, it's about 298 pages long. I can't tell you I've read it all, but I have flipped through. An historical essay on the English Constitution, or an impartial inquiry into the elective power of the people from the first establishment of the Saxons in this kingdom. And that's his thing. The elective, it's all about election and accountability for the radicals. And the Anglo-Saxons are the people on whom they model their future. So in this rather influential essay, Holm says this. He talks about the Anglo-Saxon constitution. The Saxon model, he said, represented, quote, the natural rights of mankind. They are interchangeable. They were the natural rights of mankind worked out into a political and social framework. If you get natural rights and you work them into a political and social framework, you end up with the lifestyle of the Anglo-Saxons. That's basically what he said. These things just pertain in a state of nature, so that if you look to any primitive society now, as the word he uses, look at any primitive society now, you would see that they would very naturally fall into an Anglo-Saxon way of government. If you just watch them for long enough coming together and forming a civil society. That was what it was kind of a natural thing to do. There was social equality, Holm says, in the Anglo-Saxon world. Quote, they considered every man alike as he came from the hands of his maker, whether he were rich or whether he were poor. The government of Anglo-Saxon England was structured from the bottom up. You had elections to a tithing, followed by elections to a shire, and elections to the Witenagemot, which was a kind of a primitive parliament, or sort of an early form of Anglo-Saxon parliament. There were annual elections for everything. These are real important things for them. Annual elections by universal suffrage to each of these stages of government and to everything else that happens. Only kings are not elected annually, but they are elected. Kings in the Anglo-Saxon world are elected, according to Holm, and elected for life. So you've got to be careful how you choose, but you do get to choose. And radicals that argued throughout the 1780s and 1790s that when they met in conventions and held conventions, these were not kind of anti-parliaments. These were not treasonous and things unknown to the Constitution. What those conventions were a revival of the old Witenagemots and the tithings and the shires. They were simply Anglo-Saxon reinventions, but they're not new, nothing new or dodgy about them. So those ideas of Holmes were expanded upon by another great radical, a better known radical actually, in the 1780s, a man called Major John Cartwright, who's still involved in radical politics right up into the 19th century. He again argues that there was a universal suffrage, universal franchise in the Anglo-Saxon world, enjoyed, he says, quote, from the very earliest antiquity and exercised for ages. It was a bit imprecise, but thanks. But what we do need to know is these things were taken away from us by the treachery of their representatives, via the restricted franchise of the Parliament called under Henry VI, and in particular his Disenfranchising Act, which robbed us of our rights. I do like this. This is, you can't read it, unfortunately. It's really good, this. This is an incredibly detailed sort of wall poster. I suppose it was just designed as an engraving to be hung in people's homes. But it's made on behalf of people like Major Cartwright, and it's all about this. It's all about the radical movement of the 1780s and 1770s and 1780s. It's full of these fantastic emblems all the way around it, with loads and loads of references, not just, it's called a Declaration of Rights, so it's clear about what the rights of Englishmen are, long before Paine had actually written Rights of Englishmen. It tells you what the rights of Englishmen are already, and then goes on about what's stopping us from having them. Here's some blown up parts of it. Declaration of Rights, without which no Englishman can be a free man, nor the English nation a free people. The right of making laws for this realm is, by the Constitution, lodged in the hands of King, Lords and Parliament, and the representatives of the Commons. And then it goes on to tell us that we must have the right to vote. There's no point having a right to vote if you don't use it every year. You've got to use it every year. We talked about having sometimes constitutionalists would have this idea about the Constitution as three poles equally supporting one another in a kind of a nice, loyal, and mutually supportive way. Radicals sometimes imagine it different ways. Pyramid, rather than three folds of equal size, one of lords, one of commons, and one of crown. We have it as a pyramid with the crown at the top. Yeah, it does go at the top, but it is small. And the lords, who are numerically very small too, but are at the top. And then the rest of us are the commons. And you can see that the commons are more powerful and important than the lords and the crown. But the lords and the crown are just technically on top. That's a different way of looking at the tripartite contract. Underneath it, there's this great bit here which says, you can't read it on there, but I wrote a bit of it out here. Where's it gone now? The annual exercise of elective power under the Saxon government was the quintessence, the life and the soul of their constitution. These are put on tablets of stone etched into the hearts of Englishmen who've given themselves to the reform process. Here is Major Cartwright himself, surrounded by laurels and bits and pieces, books and "Unite or Die" written underneath. This is from 1782. Then in the 1790s, Joseph Gerald, who was transported for treason for attempting to organise a convention, or being involved in the Scottish Convention of 1793, Joseph Gerald famously used his trial defence to argue in favour, constantly, completely in favour of the Anglo-Saxon constitution. That's his defence for what he had done, for holding a convention. He says, "Most adult men in the Anglo-Saxon world were small landowners, and therefore they were stakeholders in society. And they were freemen, and all freemen. That is, I mean, a freeman was anybody who was not a slave, as far as they were concerned. Not the technical definition of a freeman that grew up under law, but in common law, anyone who was not a slave. And since Charles II, Gerald argues, since Charles II had abolished slavery on English soil, all freeborn Englishmen were clearly freemen, and that must mean they were entitled to vote. It was all perfectly logical, as far as he was concerned. And these were our rights, not just, they were rights that needed to be reclaimed because they'd been stripped from us. They weren't things we had to make up. We previously had them." Thelwall actually wrote a lecture, delivered a lecture on the origins, of the Saxon origin of the English constitution, which has survived. And in this lecture he tells us that, this is his history lesson, this is what happened. "Saxon, Jute and Scandinavian settlers originally arrived on these shores in what he calls a, quote, spirit of independence," because that's the sort of people that they were. They arrived to find in sort of an Arcadian England, a lovely, beautiful England, which had, quote, "never been subjected to the pride of despotism." And these settlers became, again, quote, "not the masters just, but the people of the soil, not the hereditary subjects, but the voluntary associates of the chieftains whom they chose to follow." Norman culture, on the other hand, which is, of course, is the Norman yoke theory of history, you've heard this one before, you know, but the Normans came and sort of trashed it, and nothing has been the same since. So Norman culture was fundamentally different to the Saxon. It was hierarchical, it was centralised, it was unavailingly despotic, it was coercive, but it was undemocratic by very nature. And of course it was bloody foreign, wasn't it? It was French. Which makes it much worse. The Norman yoke theory of history explained also then the alienation of the people from their aristocracy in the 18th century, because the aristocracy were made up of French, Frenchmen, you know, people who had come over with the Conqueror. They're terribly proud of having come over with the Conqueror, many of them. Trace their trees back to that rather than to the Saxons. The greatest hero of the Anglo-Saxon constitution was Alfred, of course, the only king who ever gets a good press in radical scripts. And that's an idea, that's a very 18th century idea, that Alfred is a real invention of 18th century radicals in many ways. He exists before that in other myths, but he's really built up in the 18th century as a heroic figure. All this kind of emphasis on an Anglo-Saxon past means that radicals are having to think about history. That's what I find interesting about it. You know, they are having to reclaim their own history, which is, of course, actually what groups like this one is all about. We are reclaiming a history which appears not to have been given top billing in some establishment quarters. And the radicals of the 18th century are doing just that. And of course that means that there is going to be a backlash. There is a kind of a process of establishment historians who are trotted out to destroy the myth of the Anglo-Saxon revolution. And the arch enemy of the Anglo-Saxon constitution is David Hume, not to be confused with Obadiah Holm. David Hume is the more famous one, of course, the great Enlightenment scholar, who in the 1760s produced this great multi-volume collection of books on the history of England from the invasion of Julius Caesar to the revolution of 1688, which of course he regards as the most important thing that ever happened, so there's not much point talking about anything after that. And in it he explicitly denies the existence of an Anglo-Saxon democratic state. He won't even use the word Anglo-Saxon constitution, it's not the right way the word, to say, for what was going on in those days. And he even questions the historical justification for things like resistance theory, which the Whigs had actually been quite keen on, because it was good, which is how they explained what they'd done in 1688. I mean, you have to resist tyrants from time to time, and that's what they had done, in the nicest possible way, of course, without having a full-blown bloody revolution, and certainly no republic. Hume re-scripts the Civil War, not as an effect of the king's tyranny, but as an effect of the ambitions of Parliament. Well, look at it that way if you like, and then a king gets off the hook. It's not really his fault, it was Parliament's fault for pushing him too far. But the Whigs had, of course, built a tradition on assuming that it was actually the Civil War had come about because the king was acting in a tyrannical manner. It wasn't Parliament's fault, Parliament was put upon. So it depends how you want to look at it, I suppose. As for the rights of the Commons, House of Commons, Hume interpreted Magna Carta as a document that, that laid the basis for regular sittings of the King's Council. He's very careful about his wording, but not of a parliament, because he says it gives no specific rights to any House of Commons. So let's not pretend that Magna Carta is the basis for parliamentary democracy, because it is absolutely not. Hume, you cannot overemphasize how influential Hume has been. You know, Hume's histories sell in bucket loads. You know, they are very, very popular. People go out and buy these things. And he's turned into, in many prints, a heroic figure. That's him there, inspiring the muse of history to write. Watched over by Britannia and the recumbent lion. It's a marvellous patriotic kind of design. But Hume is the hero. But what just a Dover look as well. Get a look in the corner there. And this is a print from the sort of late 1760s, early 1770s, I think. Because Hume was a good scholar, he was quite a good historian for his day, and most radicals found themselves hard pressed to question his facts. It's his interpretation they have to get at. So it's another reason I find all this interesting, is radicals having to it's not enough just to blow facts at one another, is it, and argue about facts. What's important is how we interpret these facts. Let's know how we interpret what history's all about. They try to undermine him. They undermine him by contesting his interpretation of these facts and accusing him of making blatant Tory propaganda. Thomas Jefferson said of Hume's book, "The Whig spirit of the country has been completely sapped by it. Toryism has now become the general weed of the nation." For Thelwall, Thelwall on Hume is great. You know, want to see some vitriol? Read some Thelwall. Thelwall says, "Hume had become almost the only authority ever quoted, to their eternal disgrace, by our schoolboy senators and venal policemen," meaning his parliament. Hume was a, quote, "a flimsy novelist," quote, "an apologist for tyranny," quote, "a peddler of suppositious facts." You could go, Thelwall just, you don't mention Hume to him, he's another five paragraphs, and God, I hate this man. But Hume's scholarship might be turned against him, of course, for his work was, according to Thelwall, pregnant with facts. Very useful, because if they are properly known and digested, would they not hurl corruption from its high seat and restore the reign of liberty and justice? Just use him against our opponents. Which meant the London Corresponding Society got very interested in contesting histories, in getting into contesting Hume. And the bloke who does it best, in my view, is this guy. This guy's brilliant. John Baxter is a he's a physical force London Corresponding Society man. He joins the United Englishmen. You know, he's a physical force armed rebel, ready to rise. He's not going to just keep petitioning for the rest of his life. He's much more hard than that, Baxter. And he publishes this new and impartial history of England. I have to tell you, folks, it's not impartial. But it is bloody good. It's about 850 pages long as well. There's an awful lot there. From the earliest period of genuine historical evidence, meaning the Anglo-Saxon period, to the present important and alarming crisis, meaning the attempt of government in the 1790s to stifle free speech after 1796. So it goes on. And it's dedicated to the London Corresponding Society and all that it stands for. His main concern, Baxter's main concern is to expose, quote, the rapid strides of corruption and despotism through the various periods of our history, and defeat other histories that have cast the rights and liberties of the people into the shade. Readers could then, he says, quote, contrast the present with former times to see where our liberties are invaded or in danger, and to learn, for example, how the evil is to be prevented. So this new and impartial history of England, adorned as it was inside with portraits of Thelwall, of Hardy, of Payne, and of Horne Tooke, all members of the London Corresponding Society, and Payne, don't forget, is in here too. This book is dedicated to the people at large, and the London Corresponding Society in particular. And what it does is it heavily plagiarises Hume. It's an absolute catalogue of plagiarism. But what he does is every time he's quoted Hume, he then has this sort of, now, what he means by this, or what we should mean by this, is, so there's a sort of series of correctives and reinterpretations that follow. this is the front, you can't, it's dark, I know, but that's the frontispiece to Baxter's History. It's a nice one to put up with that picture of Hume being turned into a sort of fair-minded deity in the last picture. Because it's the frontispiece to Baxter's History, and it's Liberty, that is Britannia, you can see her there, holding up the cap of liberty on the pole, protecting the British constitution against the attacks of anarchy and despotism. Here's the constitution, it's the pyramid, right, with bright light behind it. And here she is with her shield and her cap of liberty. And here's anarchy, this is sort of... Yeah, I know, but that's not what I meant. And despotism is a king. It's this king with his... You just see a bit of his crown there. And he's sort of going, this is obviously going to destroy the constitution. So, you know, this is a good way of doing it, isn't it? Quite unlike anything that Hume would ever have sanctioned. But the thing is that despite all this, Baxter is emphatic that he will not accept Paine's interpretation of the Constitution. He will not have it that we don't have a Constitution. We do have one, he says. I've just explained it to you. That's what a bloody book is about. 850 pages to prove to you we have an Anglo-Saxon Constitution, which we must recover. But despite all that, and this is what radicals are like. There's Payne, the hero, you know. They read The Rights of Man, they just don't understand it. Well, they read it, but they read it selectively. They're careful about it. The Rights of Man, all well and good. Republicanism, no. No, not in England. No, it's not necessary. We might kill a king now and again. We need to teach them a lesson. But it doesn't mean we want a republic. It's not necessary. It shouldn't be necessary. Under the Anglo-Saxon constitution, it would never have been necessary. Baxter states the radical view of the Anglo-Saxon constitution really well, actually, in a section on Burke's beloved Magna Carta. I put the whole text up because this is really lays it out, doesn't it? On Magna Carta. To this charter, Englishmen are fond to look as the foundation of English liberty. And some maintain that it contains the substance of the Anglo-Saxon laws. But whoever examines it will perceive that its provisions are founded on the feudal system, that is, the system of the Normans. And though it contains some few regulations for the better securing of the liberty and happiness of the people, yet even these have proved so vague and illusory that it is not from them, but from the common rights of mankind. That is, well, that's in agreement with Thelwall and Payne, I suppose. And the customs of the Anglo-Saxons... Oh, okay, so that's an agreement with Thelwall, not Payne, that Englishmen must adduce their constitution and their liberties. So, now, he goes on, to Saxon institutions, quote, must Britons still look as the only effectual means of ameliorating their condition and securing those rights which have been founded in wisdom and justice, whose utility has been established by experience and sanctioned by the highest antiquity. So what we see going on here is not just a reaffirmation of the ancient constitution, but a recognition that constitutional showdowns in history were invariably not held with Parliament, but with the King, which is where the Republican fudge starts to come in. This is where it gets quite interesting. If you think about it, all these great events, from Magna Carta to Wat Tyler to the Republic of 1640, the Glorious Revolution of 1688, it's all about the people and the King in conflict. And the only king to emerge with any credit is, of course, Alfred. So, a lot of these London Corresponding Society histories concentrate on relationships with monarchs. Another one, it's anonymous, it was called The Moral and Political Acts of the Kings and Queens of England, it was published in 1793. Again, used Hume to catalogue the historical tyranny of the crown. So you can use his facts, and then you say, see, kings are terrible. Quote, we have seen the English people, for more than six centuries, oppressed either by their kings or their nobles. Their rights have been infringed and their properties have been invaded. And as for kings, we have not seen one whose reign is not defiled with blood. Thelmore was fascinated by the capacity of historic remains, sites of antiquity, castles, old ruins, to inspire constitutional thoughts. Thelmore wrote this wonderful book called The Peripatetic in 1793, which is absolutely brilliant. And in it, there's a lot of history in it, and there's a great bit where he says, did I put this one up? Have I got this one? Yeah. He's travelling around in Kent, and then he writes, in crossing the celebrated common of Dartford Brink, we were reminded not only of the sportive and pompous tournament held by Edward III in the year 1331, but also the fatal tragedy of the houses of York and Lancaster, the first act of which was performed upon this theatre in AD 1452. You know, he knows his history, he's read his Hume, he's absorbed a lot, he knows it, he's researched it, and he goes around the country looking at things, and then every time he sees something old, it reminds him, it provokes a memory, it provokes him to think about the Constitution. So in 1452, when Edward Plantagenet brought into the field an army of 10,000 men whose idle frenzy prompted them to hazard those lives which ought to have protected and supported their families in a ridiculous contest for a change of masters. But every part of this kingdom presents so many memorials to the horrible massacres by which the rights of kings have been maintained. He's a very interesting bloke. Few bones of contention over dealing with kings were more critical for radicals than that of the peasants' revolt in 1381. For Hume, and for many establishment historians who followed after him, Wat Tyler's death at Blackheath was a story about what happens when a simple bunch of God-fearing, loyal peasants, with some grievances, which are probably fairly all right, you know, they are grievances, but they get led astray by a radical demagogue who always wants more than they should have. He always pushes them further than he should. That's Tyler's role, you know. This is a version. That version of the Wat Tyler story is pushed heavily by loyalists in Britain after the American War in the 1780s, for example. And you get paintings at the Royal Academy like this one, turning up James Northcote's The Death of Wat Tyler. You know what happens, you know, Tyler is killed by the Mayor of London, Lord Walworth, isn't it? Because the story is that Walworth stabs Tyler because Tyler is facing down the King. He's not showing the King proper respect. They're meant to be meeting and parleying. And Walworth acts instinctively to protect his monarch. And the monarch sort of goes away going, well, it's a shame you had to do that. It's a shame. It's not the king's fault. It's Wat Tyler's fault. And the man who killed him wasn't the king, of course. It was the mayor, and the mayor was only acting to protect the king. So the whole thing is unfortunate, but it is, of course, all Tyler's fault. And not the king's. This picture was actually used to illustrate Hume's history. It was painted by a man called Rigaud for Bowyer's Historical Gallery, which is a gallery in London in the 1790s. But it was used in engraved form for an illustrated edition of Hume. I think it's interesting because this is Wat Tyler killing the poll tax collector, and they use a passage from Hume to talk about Hume's passage is about how wrong Tyler is to attack the poll tax collector. It's inexcusable and terrible. But in the picture, I think, you know, Tyler here is quite a sympathetic character. They've introduced this young girl who's being ravished by the tax collector, and so Tyler is there to defend him. So in fact, the print sort of rather gives the lie to the bad history, doesn't it? Or rather turns the meaning around. So it's all quite interesting. For Baxter, who we were looking at earlier, the story of Wat Tyler shows that Richard II was untrustworthy, and the people ought to have recognised, quote Baxter, their duty to have taken the most effectual means to secure themselves in future from the oppression of the king and his nobility. For Thelwall, the incident proved the necessity of dealing very firmly with tyrants. He says, once you have got them in your power, you either must lop them off or they will lop off you. But the radical interpretation of the peasants' revolt comes over really strongly in Southey's play, Wat Tyler, which Southey himself tried to suppress, you know, after it was published against his wishes. He wrote it when he was a young man in the 1790s, and Southey was there, the kind of radical, joining in with the radical movement. And then he becomes poet laureate, doesn't he, in the 19th century. And he gets very, 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 very conservative. And then they publish the play without his knowledge. And he's absolutely furious, and he tried to have it suppressed, because it says he's changed. It says things like this. This is an extract from it. King, Tyler, why have you killed my officer and led my honest subjects from their homes, thus to rebel against the Lord's anointed? Tyler, because they were oppressed. King, was this the way to remedy the ill? You should have tried by milder means. Petitioned at the throne. The throne will always listen to petitions. Tyler, King of England, petitioning for pity is most weak. The sovereign people ought to demand justice. The hour of retribution is at hand, and tyrants tremble. Mark me, King of England. That's pretty heavy stuff, isn't it? Actually? But all of it relates in 1817 to the Black Dwarf's strictures on how to petition the king robustly and with history on our side. Here's a quote from the Black Dwarf. Was John petitioned to sign Magna Carta? Was Charles petitioned to lay down his head upon the block? Was James petitioned to abdicate his throne? Or was William petitioned to accept the Bill of Rights? No, no. The right of petitioning with your ancestors meant the right of laying their grievances before the highest authority and demanding or enforcing an attention to their wrongs. Petitioning, then, is all very well. It's not petitioning itself which is irrelevant, contra pain, okay? It's just that its meaning requires a proper interpretation. We're reminded then that constitutionalism paradoxically creates a blueprint for confrontations with the crown, and this is why republicanism rather misses the point in the 1790s as far as the English radical tradition is concerned, because it's understood there's nothing wrong amongst most English radicals with having a head of state as a king or a queen or whatever, as long as they're accountable in some way. They must be accountable. The ancient constitution was all about accountability, which is why we vote annually in it and why all people can vote. This is why radicals spent so much time in the 1790s petitioning the throne, laying endless petitions before the throne, because they've got this, they know. They haven't read this lot through. They know that all those great changes that were made in British history, apparently by petitioning, yeah, they were made by petitioning, but it was petitioning at the end of a bayonet. You know, it was a force, and the Constitution kind of allows for it. It was understood by most radicals that the first thing you do when you tackle the king is send him an address, a sort of a private address. You know, this is what we think needs to be done, sire, your lordship. And you wait for a response. When you don't get one, you send him a second address, a little bit more forceful. But finally, you send him a remonstrance. This was just this was a language people understood and used. The remonstrance was an extremely robust and forceful address, and it was the last warning. And in the remonstrance, you would often write things like, "It would be unfortunate for us to have to remind you of what happened to Charles I when he refused to acknowledge remonstrances from his people, wouldn't it? It would be unfortunate," those kind of things. Because we're not suggesting that we want anything like that to happen to you, because we love you. but there's a... so that what they're doing is putting in course a train of events which can ultimately lead, in their view, legally and constitutionally, to rebellion. and to insurrection and to the replacement of a monarch and possibly to the replacement of a government that supports the monarch. You know, there's a mechanism in place, in other words, for constitutional rebellions. It's not republicanism, it's not really revolution, but revolution and insurrection are entirely different things, of course, when you think about it. And the constitutional road led them to these sort of possibilities. So, to summarise at the end, I just wondered, these are the things I think we have to understand, if we're going to understand radical constitutionalism. We have to understand there was a radical belief that constitutional law and custom could be manipulated to wrestle concessions from a corrupt state when other options were impractical. That's the first thing, through mechanisms like this. We have to understand, given the power of the state to restrict and repress liberty by suspending habeas corpus whenever they felt like it or whatever else they might like to do, because of course they can, the strongest hand radicals could play was not to appeal to natural law and reason, as Paine urged them to do, or as Godwin urged them to do for that matter, and by so doing refuse to recognise the authority of the court, in other terms I suppose. Their strongest hand was, on the contrary, to defend the common law against what they saw as an encroachment by tyrannical ministers and their king. Well, their king, of course, is there to correct the tyrannical ministers, if only he'll listen. We have to understand the radical insistence that history is therefore useful, not an obstruction, but useful as an index to the process, as a system of revelation. The whole history of England after 1066, for the radicals, is revealed as a process of struggle for the recovery of lost rights, with successes and failures along the way. Magna Carta, 1688, these are staging posts, but they're not end results. And they're not first principles either. We need to understand that radical constitutionalism made loyalist arguments that abstract reason had been proven at fault in the anarchy of the French Revolution, that sort of thing. You can't have, as I Burke sort of famously said, didn't he? You can't just invent a constitution because it looks nice. You can't just say, oh, you know, wouldn't it be good? Why don't we sit there and work out a rational constitution and impose it upon ourselves? You can't do it in practice. You can't do it. And if you look at what happened in France, they would say, you know, this is not radical speaking, this is loyalist speaking, the ministerialists, the conservative forces. You can see that it all goes wrong. It ends in blood. Revolution devours its own children. Why? Because it's not based on anything that anyone has any real understanding or attachment to. If you adopt a constitutional radical position, of course, it's much less easy for loyalists to level that argument at English radicals. Much more difficult for loyalists to charge radicals with seditious speech every time they speak. And Paineite language, of course, was always regarded as seditious speech and proceeded against that law, prosecuted. You have to understand, too, that critically, the whole point of the Saxon precedent was that it offered radicals a way of expressing support for natural rights, because they said the Anglo-Saxon precedent was actually built upon natural rights, without libelling the constitution by following Paine's claim that we didn't have a constitution. You just got sort of got around that problem. In this way, radicals like Major Cartwright, who we looked at earlier in the 1770s and 80s, had led the way to the rights of man within a constitutionalist framework before Paine made the notion famous by publishing The Rights of Man, his own text, in 1791-2. We have to understand then that radicals understood very well that the notion of the ancient constitution was a contestable one, a discursive one, a fluid one, an argumentative one. One you have to, as I said at the beginning, a constitution of the mind as much as anything else. John Fellwell says, the constitution is an enchanted castle. Enter it with care. And of course, when you get in there, it's full of people like Edmund Burke, who must be taken out. And they have to be ejected and dealt with as you pursue your way through it. So the final point, I think, is that all this, what all this does is to make radicals deeply, deeply interested in the history of their own country and the idea of using history, using the past, using precedent, using it, memory, to collectively construct and recognise national truths, construct truths of a historic nature. And I'll leave it there. I haven't told you anything about Tom Paine, which I apologise.
I don't know if there's any precedent for this, but we've been suggested we have a heat and coffee break.
Yeah.
Do the questions. So we vote with that if you want that. So, yeah.
I can hear people's knees knocking together, and I thought it was applause for a moment.